Welcome and thank you for joining us for the NAHU Healthcare Happy Hour, the official podcast of the National Association of Health Underwriters. This week has been among the busiest for NAHU's priorities, with a flurry of activity both at the legislative and regulatory levels. This includes the introduction of several pieces of NAHU's priority legislative issues, such as treating COBRA as creditable coverage, the HIT tax repeal, and Medicare notices, as well as key developments on drug pricing and surprise medical bills. NAHU's Marcy Buckner and John Green will help break down all of this activity and what to make of it in the coming weeks. Before we begin, please take a moment to subscribe to the podcast on iTunes, Stitcher, or Spotify, and to rate us. The podcast is posted every Friday on these platforms ahead of being distributed through NAHU's member-exclusive health policy newsletter, The Washington Update, giving you a head start on your weekly healthcare happy hour. The big whoop this week has been the sheer amount of healthcare news. We'll get into each of these issues throughout today's discussion, but can you give us a quick overview of the major issues happening legislatively and regulatorily?
Sure. If you were paying attention to the news this week, it may not have seemed like much of this was in the headlines, but we have been busy at work with a lot of healthcare issues here in DC. On the legislative side, we are introducing our COBRA as creditable coverage bill in the House and close to dropping it in the Senate. We had the health insurance tax full repeal bill introduced in the House. We sent out one of our grassroots efforts, our Operation Shout system, allowing you all to message your members of Congress on the STAR Act, which passed unanimously out of the House Ways and Means Committee, which is a bill that will help promote transparency in prescription drugs. The Bennies Act, which will assist in providing information to those who are newly eligible for Medicare. The Democrats' bill to alter the guidance provided in October by the Trump administration for the 1332 waiver or state innovations. And finally, on the legislative side, legislation that would alter what we call the orange and purple book for prescription drug prices. And we'll talk exactly about what that means in a little bit. It's more than just the color of the book. On the regulatory side, we submitted comments to a request for information from the administration on selling insurance across state lines. We saw the final version of the direct-to-consumer ads rule from HHS, and the White House surprised us with a press conference on surprise billing.
One of the most recurring healthcare plans offered by Republicans is to allow the sale of insurance across state lines. The administration offered a version of this with their association health plan rule last year, but recently they proposed new guidance to encourage these plans. NAHU submitted comments on this proposal this week. Can you give us an overview of what we relayed to the administration?
So a couple of weeks ago, we received the request for information from the Trump administration asking about selling insurance across state lines, what that means, what it could look like, why states aren't doing it, what the interest level is, how the system could work. And our response to the administration was that this is actually something that is already allowed. The state compact, which allows states to join the state compact. If you join the state compact, then you can elect to then sell across state lines with those states that are a member of the compact. Right now, there are 5 states that have joined the state compact, but none of them have actually engaged in selling insurance across state lines. Much of this is because that states are very different in the way that their marketplaces are set up and the risk pools within their borders. There's also a large amount of concern about how provider networks would work if you're selling across state lines, especially if you're selling insurance across the country. What happens if you are in New Jersey and you're enrolled in a plan from California? How is your provider network going to work? So we pointed out many of these concerns in our comments to the administration. I don't think that any of these comments will come as a surprise to them. Selling across state lines has been something that's not new. It's something that's been talked about for decades, which John can attest to. He's worked on it for for more years than I have.
Yes, I have.
But this is the first time we're seeing them more engaged and actually asking about how this could work, which our response is also that they need to study this very carefully before trying to implement anything too drastic. Again, just because of the fact that states technically have the ability to do this now, but they're not. And there are reasons why.
Oh, and not to mention the fact that if they built it, carriers are not rushing to offer plans for sale either.
Right. We're seeing fewer and fewer carriers in the states, especially the individual market. And so putting together a system like this, I think, would not lead to more competition, unfortunately.
The White House is also looking to roll out their plan to address surprise medical bills with an announcement by President Trump on Thursday. What can we expect on this issue, and what has NHU been doing to shape the debate?
I think that the drug issue is starting to wind down a bit. There are plans to bring a lot of bills to the floor in the coming weeks on drug pricing. And the Senate is also poised very soon to do the same. And so I think as this starts to get some closure on it, surprise billing is heating up. And in fact, on some of our coalition calls, we've been talking about it. And I think that the president is sending a signal about it. I'm hoping it's more of a signal than a pathway on how to do it. He laid out some markers and guardrails around, you know, what he thinks ought to happen relative to consumers being subjected to surprise billing, but still leaving it largely up to Congress. But it's clear in our discussions with the Congress so far is that there's more education needed. The white coats are up there in force talking about what providers need. And I think we're coming to the realization that there's more education that needs to be done relative to the employer role in all of this. After all, we pay the bills for 181 million people. And some of the rules that are ideas that they're talking about affects different markets, different employers differently. And I don't think that that's understood.
And as I mentioned at the top of the podcast, the Trump administration held a surprise press conference on surprise billing. It wasn't so much a surprise to us. We had a heads up.
We did. And in fact, the White House reached out to me and asked if I could help assist with a particular case that I had shared with them. And we did so. And by all accounts, that person was actually there.
And there were a couple of folks that shared their stories at the press conference, as well as a surgeon who sees this from time to time with his patients. And then the president laid out the four principles, John, that you alluded to, that they would like to see observed as Congress moves towards putting together language. And these four principles include that in an emergency care scenario in which patients have no meaningful opportunity to choose either their medical facility or their providers, they should not bear the additional burden of costs billed by out-of-network providers or facilities who are not covered by their healthcare plans. The other principle is that in a scenario in which patients schedule their appointments to receive facility-based care, they should have information available on the network status of all their providers and the facility, pricing information about the providers and the services reasonably expected to be needed, and out-of-pocket costs for which they will be responsible. So that at the time the care is scheduled, patients should receive a written estimate of the cost or of the scheduled care after the application of insurance deductibles, copayments, or co-insurance requirements, or of the total cost if they are uninsured. The third principle is that charges for services rendered by an out-of-network provider for which patients have not been informed or have not given informed consent at an in-network hospital or medical facility should be included in a single bill, regardless of the relationship any out-of-network providers may have with the facility. So in other words, out-of-network providers cannot separately bill patients absent advance informed consent, and patients would be responsible for any coinsurance or copayments that would be applied had the care been provided in-network. And then the last principle is that federal healthcare expenditures should not increase as a result of any legislation they put together.
Well, we also don't want private premiums going up as a consequence either. And as you can tell by some of these principles, there's still gaping holes here. If anesthesiologists and laboratories and that can all opt out and just simply provide whatever the list price is for their services, that isn't really very helpful. It still puts you between, you know, a rock and a hard place. And so there's a long way to go on this issue, and that's why we are planning in the coming weeks to really up our presence on the Hill on this.
And the president did say that they expect legislation to be put together within the next week or two. So hopefully we'll get some language soon. I think one of the good things about these four principles that they shared with us is that there is not the provision that we saw in the Cassidy draft from the last legislative session, which would have put the responsibility on employers and carriers to make up that difference of a balance bill, which we all know would cause to arise in premiums across the board. So Senator Cassidy was there at the press conference, but that provision from his bill was not included in the principles. And we hope that is something that remains out of the legislation as they draft it.
A sign of some small progress.
Yes.
Another item that the White House has been promoting is greater transparency in prescription drugs, as they finalized their proposal this week to require drug manufacturers to disclose the prices of medications in advertising. How will this work, and what are NIH's positions on this?
Well, if you ask the pharmaceutical industry, they say that it won't work, that it's too complicated, that it's going to be confusing, etc. No one really knows how much of this is just sort of a public affairs kind of move thing, or if it'll actually lead to lowering of prices. It is a baby step, probably at best.
So what the final rule does is it requires drug manufacturers to disclose drug prices within direct-to-consumer advertisements. And drug manufacturers will be required to disclose the list price, which is the cost of the drug before health insurance or other subsidies come into play, if that price is greater than or equal to $35 for a usual prescription amount of that drug. Secretary Azar said that he believes that requiring the inclusion of drugs, list prices, and TV ads is the single most significant step any administration has taken toward a simple commitment, and that American patients deserve to know the prices of the healthcare they receive. When John talks about this and critics saying that this could possibly be confusing, it's because they are being required to provide the list price, which can vary significantly on different drugs, and how that list price is calculated when you're looking at how much the consumer will actually pay once they get to the pharmacy, once their insurance has been calculated into that. So when we say it's confusing, it's because oftentimes when consumers see something on TV and they see an ad and they see how much it costs, if they go to the pharmacy and that cost is not what they see, even if it could be lower, it could be higher, that is very confusing. Some others that are criticizing the rule are concerned that the list prices, because many of them will be higher than what the patient would see at the pharmacy, especially if they have insurance, is that this could prevent patients from seeking care because they may see that list price and think that it's so astronomical that they may think that they need care but may not be able to afford it, even though if they have insurance, it could be a much lower cost for them than what they see in the advertisement. However, because the rule would require these list prices to be provided, HHS does believe that this could drive competition in the pharmaceutical industry if those prices are more transparent, which is something that we do advocate for, is transparency in the prescription drug market and the health insurance market in general. But 47% of Americans are enrolled in high deductible health plans, and they will be paying specifically the list price of a drug until they've met their deductible. So the argument about how confusing this is and whether they're going to see that price when they get to the pharmacy goes kind of both ways when you look at the percentage of how many Americans are actually going to pay that list price versus those that won't.
So I hope Secretary Azar is right, that it does help move the needle. It's a multifaceted problem, and there will be many other options to deal with drug pricing coming in the next few weeks.
There is a 60-day implementation timeframe for this rule, so you could see those list prices being included on your commercials as soon as this summer, although there is word that there may be some challenges to the rule that may delay its implementation.
Looking at Congress, NIHU activated Operation Shout this week in support of legislation to provide greater transparency for prescription drugs. What are some of the key provisions of this legislation?
This legislation requires drug manufacturers to justify any large increases and high launch prices for their drugs. And I'll tell you exactly what that means. What they're looking at as large price increases are drug price increases by more than 10% or $10,000 over 1 year, or 25% or $25,000 over 3 years, or if the manufacturer launches a new drug at or above $26,000 to be adjusted over time. It also requires manufacturers of certain drugs, devices, biologics, or medical supplies to report the aggregate value and quantity of samples given to providers, so how many free samples they're giving out, as well as the amount for how much they claim as a business expense deduction. It requires a report of drugs given in the inpatient setting, including drug costs, spending and volume, spending per admission by the hospital and hospital size, as well as an analysis of drug shortages in an inpatient hospital setting. It requires public disclosure of any rebates, discounts, and other price concessions achieved by pharmaceutical benefit managers or PBMs, and to disclose generic drug dispensing rates by the PBM. And then lastly, it requires all drug manufacturers to report the average sales price for physician-administered drugs covered under Medicare Part B. And this does come with a fine totaling $10,000 for each day the manufacturer fails to report the information, and up to $100,000 for each item of false information. So I know that sounded like a lot of what the bill will do, but really we're looking at this as a huge transparency bill when it comes to how prescription drugs are priced, how we're seeing them being used by providers and how those samples are being used, the effect that hospitals have in the way that a drug is used and prescribed, and the role of PBMs, which is increasingly coming under scrutiny and is something that the administration is looking at, and actually something we're going to meet with them about next week.
This is the bill that we prefaced at the beginning that Marcy said was passed unanimously in the Ways and Means Committee. So that means that Republicans were on board with this package as well. And so this is only the first step. It then has to go to the floor. The Senate will do with their package. If it doesn't match what the House has done, there'll be a conference. So there's a long way to go before something gets to the president. So if there are parts of this that you disagree with, just know that this is an evolving kind of process, and this is kind of how the sausage is made in D.C.
There are several other key bills moving in Congress this week, including more prescription drug bills and the House Democrats' effort to roll back the Trump administration's waiver guidance. What are some of the key takeaways here?
So we did have a hearing on the floor this week about what they're calling the Purple Book Continuity Act of 2019 that I mentioned earlier. And this would just put into law a way that patents are published for approved biological products and require them to be published electronically on the FDA's website, and also monitor how frequently that's updated, and to direct the FDA to consider the types of patents that should possibly be listed in this purple book to look if it should be beyond the biologics or other types of specific types of products.
Which is different than the orange book, Marcy.
Which is different than the orange book. And this was also something that was heard this week. The Orange Book Transparency Act of 2019, which would help to ensure that this collection of pharmaceuticals is accurate and up-to-date by requiring manufacturers to share complete and timely information with the FDA, as well as ensuring that the patents for this line of drugs are relevant to the approved drug product. Oftentimes, patents are found to be invalid, and this would help to make sure that those are removed immediately from the list in the Orange Book, and things are kept to be up to date. So similar to some of the requirements that we see across in the states, where we talk often, and this is probably more of something people can relate to, is the updating of provider networks. This is kind of making sure that the update of drug patents and information is happening in real time instead of having a lag that could be detrimental.
It's all about getting these new drugs to market and not creating any kind of barriers to that process.
And then your question about the Democrats' waiver bill. So A couple of weeks ago, we saw the Democrats come out with their package for market stability, the Protecting Americans with Pre-Existing Conditions Act, and this included several different pieces. Now we have a bill also in the House with a very similar name that does not have the long list of provisions for market stabilization that we saw in the previous bill. This bill would singularly strike the October guidance that the Trump administration provided for the 1332 state innovation waivers. And there has been a lot of criticism about this. The Republicans on the committee are asking for amendments because they feel like the title is misleading because it does talk about protecting pre-existing conditions in the title, but then is just about rolling back that extra flexibility that was allowed by the Trump administration for the state innovation waivers. So some of the titles that some of the Republicans are teasingly trying to amend the bill to include are Don't Let States Innovate Act. This bill actually has nothing to do with Protecting Americans with Pre-Existing Conditions Act. This bill limits healthcare choices act. Nothing in this bill would eliminate Pre-Existing Conditions Act. And the insert politically punchy title that doesn't reflect the bill substance act. So as you can tell, there is a lot of sass that's going on in Congress with this bill. And like I said, critics do say that the Democrats are using misleading bill titles to try to manipulate votes on this. So I think it's easy to say that we're going to see a lot of changes to this bill if it moves forward, because like I said, it just has that single provision. But Republicans are trying to insert other pieces. House Minority Whip Steve Scalise has offered an amendment that would disqualify states that don't have born alive protections. So a lot of controversial pieces are being added in to really prevent this piece from going forward.
So following the 18 election where Republicans got hammered on pre-X, they're not for taking away pre-existing condition protections. And so this is why they're in such a fervor over this, because they disagree with the underlying elements of the underlying bill and want to vote no, but feel that given that title, they'll be hammered in commercials that look what they did. They voted against the pre-existing conditions bill. And that's why there's all this fervor over it. I've heard it quite a bit on the Hill.
It's now time for the senior moment, NAHU's overview of key happenings in Medicare and long-term care policy. John, as the lead of these issue areas, what is your senior moment for the week?
Well, we're very pleased to announce that Chris and I have been able to get sponsors for the COBRA bill as credible coverage, and it would eliminate the 10% penalty for life and provide a special enrollment opportunity for those that missed that mark.
And this penalty goes into place if for some reason you age into Medicare and for some reason you don't go into Medicare, you go into COBRA, that you are then penalized that 10% penalty per month for life. And our bill would allow for a one-time special enrollment period for someone to go from COBRA onto Medicare without having that penalty attached.
We are planning an operation shout once we are ready to drop the Senate bill, but we're very excited about that development and we look forward to your help with that. And the other bill that dropped, many of you have told me, as I've talked to Medicare summits about, asked about the Bennies bill, and that has also been reintroduced. And what it essentially does is it forces the federal agencies to actually talk to each other and provide information in the way that it was always envisioned that they do anyway. But it also is very supportive of agents and brokers in the bill, and we've been supportive of that legislation. It's just another piece that's helpful to have in place. So we'll be writing a letter of support for that as well.
Yes, and it provides a group to look at exactly how that information goes out to newly eligible Medicare recipients. And there is a spot in that group, that working group, for an agent or broker because of the work that we've done in the past congressional sessions.
It's now time for the NAHU Healthcare Happy Hour's Toast of the Week. What are we toasting to this week?
This week, we are toasting to the memory of Robert Payer. He is a veteran healthcare reporter who passed away on Tuesday at the age of 69 after suffering a stroke. For 40 years, Robert covered policy for the Washington Bureau of the New York Times, earning a reputation as one of the most influential health policy journalists on the healthcare beat. And they actually retired the health beat at the New York Times. They're calling it something else because every week when they would call out health, they would say, by Robert Pierre, health by Robert Pierre was the way that the beat was always announced. And they felt that after 40 years, there could not be health by anyone else.
And, you know, we've worked very closely with Robert Pierre over the years. Janet had a very close relationship with Robert. He always came to us with questions. He was a very unique journalist, for sure.
I remember the first time I met him, and it was at an insurance commissioner meeting, and he was carrying around an old C-SPAN book festival tote, and it was full of newspapers from that day, just full. And I know that he read every word in each of them, but he will be remembered for his kindness and sincerity and the unyielding dedication he brought to telling the stories that shaped our nation.
Cheers!
Thank you for joining us for this week's installment of the NAHU Healthcare Happy Hour, the official podcast of the National Association of Health Underwriters. For more information on NAHU's government affairs efforts, or to join as a member of NAHU, visit nahu.org.